Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage, page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual, in our personal stories, describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that any alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on the AABlueChipSpeaker.org desperately in need will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, and I must have this thing. I'm going to let Lisa introduce our speaker tonight, y'all. Well, so I introduce to you, Lisa.
Hey, I'm Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic.
Lisa.
And I met Tom when I first got sober. I was friended by a guy, an old-timer. He was friends with my sponsor. So I was hanging out with him and his sober folks. Tom was one of them, and he was very inspirational and fun, and I was just impressed with how much knowledge he had of the Big Book. I've known him all these years. I give you Tom McNally.
I'm Tom. I'm a recovered alcoholic. When I met Lisa, I was skinny and had black hair. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I weighed 149 pounds. I did a lot of, I heard it said here one time, side dishes. You know, oh yeah, I respect the language of Alcoholics Anonymous. My story's got a lot of those other things in it because that's what got me here at 23, you know. And I walked in here, and this well-dressed old-timer says, I spilled more liquor than you drank, son. And I'm like, well, damn. It's a shame you spilled so much. If you got it in your mouth, you might have got here before you had 1 foot in the grave, you know. So I got off to a good start here. So I'm an Atlanta native. I was born in Piedmont, grew up in Gwinnett County, and I'm the youngest of five, Irish Catholic family, and three brothers and two sisters. When we had a dispute, we put on the boxing gloves and went in the backyard and settled it, you know, and that's how I learned to settle things, you know. Conflict resolution was not a specialty of mine. So, yeah, but, you know, my brothers were 8 and 12 years older than me, so I strapped on their gloves with the neighbor's son. And I heard my sponsor talking one day, and he was an Irish guy. He died in December, and he said, when we were kids and we got in trouble, we strapped on the gloves. And I'm like, damn, I thought I was the only one. So, you know, when I got here, I thought I had kind of a crappy childhood. But, you know, being around here for a few years and in the middle of this thing and hearing people's footsteps, my childhood was a breeze. You know, my dad, he ran a underground lawn sprinkler system company, and he did like Three River Stadium, Fulton County Stadium, and it was nothing for him to be meeting with Jack Nicklaus or Arnold Palmer when they were designing golf courses. So the first drink I remember having, he was talking to a guy in the kitchen, and he pulled out a good old PBR, and he hadn't even opened it yet. He said, I said, can I have a sip? He says, sure. So I'm like 8 years old. I take it off and bring it back empty. And he looks at it and kind of laughs and reached in and got his own, you know. I mean, I think they invented whiskey to keep the Irish from taking over the world, you know. It just took to it like a fish to water. Now, I don't remember any magic feeling or anything, you know. But I remember my first drunk, you know. I remember my first drink. I don't remember my first Coca-Cola. anything like that, but I remember my first drink. That's kind of a little red flag. So when I was 12 years old, even at 12, I couldn't stand to see somebody leave half a glass of any kind of alcohol. I thought that was that's alcohol abuse right there. So we were at this wedding, and we helped clean up after the wedding, and every time there was a glass that had something in it, I drank it, and I got really drunk. And people thought it was really funny, and I liked being the center of attention, and much as I like being the center of attention, this isn't my favorite thing to do. I really enjoyed the feeling of, you know, being a little drunk kid and the center of attention, and I couldn't wait to feel that again. You know, fast forward about three more years, I was drinking every weekend, and that led to spoken things and everything else. You know, I wasn't an IV user, but I did everything you could do other ways, you know, so... You know, I was kind of like, I'm dating myself here. I think it was Life Cereal, the commercial. Mikey likes it. You know, when some new drug or something came out, they'd give it to me and see how I acted and go, well, Tom likes it. It must be safe, you know. So, yeah, I was that kid in high school. There's there's one in every party. There's one in every school, every class, the class clown. If I was dared to do something, then it was pretty much done, you know. And you know, I look back at some of the stuff I did, and I'm just amazed that you know, God saw fit for me to live long enough to get here and be in a position to help other people. You know, I'm gonna fast. I'll be all over the place. I detail cars for a living. I love what I do. Today was an ADD day, and I took 8 hours to detail one stinking little car today, just because I guess I could, you know. It's my company, so. Yeah, you know, about 3 years ago, My sobriety day is March the 6th, 1986. I was, like I said, I was 23 when I got here, just before my 24th birthday. Went to a place called Bronner's on Atlanta Road, and I was in there a few days, and my roommate decided to trim his beard in the sink, and it was just gnarly looking. And so I was waiting outside the door for him to come out. I was going to knock him out because that's the way I resolve things, right? So something comes on the intercom and goes, Dr. Strong to Unit 7, you know, immediately. And these three guys came down there and took me to the psych part of the place. And I spent like 5 days over there, a day in the rubber room, and... oh yeah, that was fun. So, and when I came back to the unit, people already, something was different about some of them already after like 5 days. All of a sudden my stupid jokes weren't so funny and my class clown act wasn't a hit anymore. And I found out what happened. They had an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that night, and that was my first meeting ever. I didn't know anything about it. And this guy walked in. He was well put together, well dressed, had his chin up, confident, carried himself well. I'm like, that guy's nothing like me at all. And then he shared. I'm thinking I'm at a Georgia Tech game. That thing used to go off when they made a first down, so it didn't go off very often, unfortunately. So, yeah, this guy starts sharing, and his message had depth and weight. which is experience and solution that the Dr. Silkworth talks about in the doctor's opinion. In other words, when he talked, I could see he had been where I'd been. And I could look at him and listen to him when he started talking about solution and see that he had found a way out. You know, he had a peace and a serenity, a peaceful look in his eyes that I had never had, even a glimpse of. You know, except maybe when I had the right combination going, you know. On my way to a blackout was as good as it got for me, you know. When they gave out the chips, I went up there and got a white chip. I didn't know what it was for. I just knew everybody clapped and I got attention, right? So every time they brought a meeting and they offered the chips, I walked up there and got a white chip. The first one I got was because there was this gorgeous 6-foot-tall brunette giving out the chips, you know. So anyway, after the fourth time in a row I did that, I heard this lady when I was walking by on my way to get a chip. She goes, "Uh-oh, I'm being recorded. What is that asshole doing?" I went, "What do you mean?" She goes, "Well, you only pick up a white chip if you've been drinking. You only need one." So the next three times I gave out chips, I walked up and gave one back till I only had one. So I know nothing's unique, but I haven't heard that story before. So anyway, I spent 34 days in a 28-day treatment center, and they put me on Navane, Artane, lithium, you know, big old long list of stuff. I mean, I walked around like a zombie with my arms out, and they said, "We want you to stay another week." I said, "This was a cash job. I am broke." They went, "Well, we want you to go to a halfway house." I went, "Okay." So went to a halfway house and immediately got put on the hot seat. I was the new guy there. I wasn't afraid to tell anybody. I know you find this hard to believe, but I wasn't afraid to tell anybody what I thought, whether it was right or wrong. So I got put on the hot seat. I didn't like those guys, and they didn't like me. So we went to, not aftercare, it's not really IOP, it was called something different then, but, you know, we went to courses during the day, and I met a girl there and figured out that the, anyway, I met a girl there, somebody from Mar found out. They said, "You've been he-ing and she-ing." They said this in the community meeting. "When can you leave?" I jumped up and said, "How about right now?" And they said, "Hold on. Sit down here a minute." And this guy that I really hated him, and he hated me, to tell you the truth. He said, "You know, you don't have to drink over any of this stuff." And I heard that, and I felt that. And I knew that that guy might not like me, but he gave a damn whether I drank again, you know. It was my first experience with unconditional love in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, so I got booted out of there, took out a little loan, went to a halfway house up here. It was called Turnaround. And I started coming to meetings here. I had a couple months, walked in. This bald-headed guy named Elliot was about 6'2". And he sounded like a genius. He sounded like he had it all together and he had all the answers. And he was just quoting the big book, but I hadn't read the thing, so I didn't know. Asked him to sponsor me. I said, "What do you want me to do?" He says, "Read the big book." He read a 164. I read it, I called him, I said, "What do I do now?" He goes, "Read it again." So he made me read it twice, and then he started taking me through the step process, and I balked at 4. You know, I just tell you right now, I just wasn't going to do that. And he said, "You know what? When you've done that third step, you'll find yourself with a pen in your hand writing." When I had 6 months, I looked over at this girl, and she looked at me, and it was on. She was the answer to my problems. Month and a half later, we moved in together. Boy meets girl on AA campus. Everything was cool. Shortly after my first birthday, we split. My roommates were all at a meeting one night, and I was sitting alone at the house. I went, it's a good thing there's not a bottle of liquor in the house. I'd be drunk right now. I call my sponsor, and he goes, quit effing around and start writing. So I started writing my fourth step, and I stayed up all night and wrote it. And he was busy the next day. I went to the Triangle Club men's meeting Saturday morning and said, hey, I need to do a fifth step with somebody. I was thinking about drinking last night. And this guy goes, you'll recognize this voice, Lisa. If you're thinking about drinking, why don't you just go drink? I said, because there's a big difference between a thought and a desire. And I won't tell you what I said after that. So somebody volunteered to hear my fifth step. I went over to his house. He told me some of his story. We built a trust, and I told him my fifth step, and I got relief, you know. And it wasn't all, listed the defects of character, made the eighth step list. There was some pretty crappy stuff in there. Didn't faze me. I was so happy to have something to work with. You know, and later I took it to my sponsor, did my fifth step with him because, he needed to know me well to work with me. So I went home for an hour, did my review, did I leave anything out? Skip on the cement, put in the foundation. One of the questions is, are the stones properly in place? And to me, I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous, I just speak for me. But the stones are the second step is the cornerstone. It talks about that in the book. The cornerstone is hope, a willingness to believe. And the third step is the keystone. That's the stone at the top of an arch. It's wedge-shaped. It holds all the other stones in place. It bears the weight. Without it, the arch crumbles. It's worthless. That's the nature of my relationship with God today. My higher power is a Jewish carpenter, so that's just for me. And that's kind of recent. I won't go into graphic detail about it, but I had an experience in March that changed my whole freaking life with 36 years, on my 36th birthday. So, squirrel. Oh, man. Yeah, the keystone. He's the father, we're his children. That statement changed the nature of my relationship with God. When I got here, my sponsor goes, where are you at with the God thing? I said, there is one, he's out to get me. He goes, okay, there's two things you need to know. There is one, you're not it. You know, and I just learned, not necessarily what they said, because I went back years later after being in sobriety and heard a whole different message. Their message hasn't changed. What I heard was I wasn't even worthy to make the approach. I compared me to you, and I'd see people dressed well, doing well, had nice things. I go, well, God's doing for them, you know, but I just don't think he'll do for me, you know. And I found a kind and loving God in Alcoholics Anonymous that allows me to be human and make mistakes, you know. And a lot of big book thumpers don't like this. It's in the 12 of 12. There you go, Rusty. Bill Wilson said, hey, you can use the group as your higher power because here's a group of people that have done what I didn't have the power to do. So they are certainly a power greater than myself. That was my first positive higher power. My first higher power was the Gwinnett County Police Department. When I knocked out the manager of the bowling alley on my way out the door, and this cop grabbed me, and I had a cast on my leg up to my hip, and he tossed me around, and I was telling him I wasn't, my God, going to jail. Guess what? I went with a couple of lumps on my head. So, you know, it says we have a list of people we've harmed whom are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. So when I do an inventory with somebody, unless we're running really long and their attention span is shot, or if we have another something else to do, I make the list right there while we're list of defects. We're looking for a few patterns. You know, when I have somebody write their inventory, it's top to bottom. Column one, I'm resentful at people, principles, or institutions. Top to bottom. Column two, 11 words or less. And here's why I do that. It's a resentment. You remember it in detail. I'm resentful at my ex-girlfriend. Why? She cheated. Okay, that's enough. We can discuss it in detail when we sit down for step five, because you can discuss a novel a lot quicker than you can read the damn thing, you know. And it makes fifth steps short and to the point. Because if you let people write pages and paragraphs, they're just trying to shape their story to make themselves look good in your eyes. They're justifying it. They jump into the victim role, and, you know, there are some things that people were actually victims. They were kids. They couldn't defend themselves, you know. What do you say to somebody like that? The big book doesn't say what was my part. It says what was the exact nature of our wrongs. And, you know, I tell a guy, I say, you know, in that situation, you know what your wrong was? 40 years later, you're still treating people badly based on what happened then. If you need therapy, whatever, let's work through it, you know, and get you to God. That's my job, my sponsor told me. Get them to God, you know. And, you know, victimized people get sober every day. Victims don't. Victims continue to live in the problem year after year, month after month, day after day. And they never take the steps to get to the other side of it and heal. Sometimes the healing comes when you look across the table at somebody and go, I did that. That happened to me. Here's what I did about it, and here's where I'm at today. I'm not a doctor. I don't play one, but I have some specific experiences that I know can help somebody. You know, so... you know, and then when we set out to make amends, it says 9 times out of 10, the unexpected happens. I made amends to my mother. I said, is there anything you need to say? What can I do to make it right? She had plenty to say. Did I disappear for months, fall off the face of the earth, and they were relieved that they found out I was in jail because they knew where I was? You know, 9 times out of 10, the unexpected happens. I go to my dad. What can I do to make it right? He goes, $21,346 at 12 cents. You know, he's an engineer, mathematician. So, so I started paying him a little bit every month. It was a small amount. I wasn't making much money. I made an amount that I could honor every month. I didn't bite off more than I could chew because I'm building a new track record. And I paid him a few months, and he said, that's enough. I just wanted to see you do the right thing. You know, that was unexpected. Twice the unexpected happened. First, he gave a dollar amount, and second, he forgave the debt. You know, and God does good things for me that I never see coming. You know, I mean, he's always there. And a lot of times it seems like the last minute, But it's on his timetable, not mine. You know, a few months ago, I was like $150 short on rent. It's Thursday. It was due on Friday. Girl's riding with me. The phone rings. It says unknown caller on my monitors. I said, you know who that is? She goes, who? I went, somebody with just enough money to pay the bills. And that's exactly what it was. You know, I just don't worry. It's a waste of stinking time. Because of the experience I had March the 6th of last year, I don't spend time worrying. It's a waste of time. I make plans. They're not set in stone, you know. You know, it's so important to run the amends stuff by your sponsor. And I'll give you an example. If somebody else could be affected by my amends, then I have to have their permission to make it. You know, and an example is, Bill gives the example in the book. Maybe you padded the expense account. Most of us have done that kind of thing, it says. So, this guy was a salesman. He went to the Skyland Group. He was a salesman and, padded the expense account for years, ripped off the company for thousands. He goes, to his sponsor, I want to make amends. He goes, you need your wife's permission. He goes to her. She goes, oh, hell no. You're not going to clear your conscience at the expense of this family. What if you get fired, lose your reputation, can't even get another job? We're all ruined. She goes, you're going to have to pray about it and live with it. So he went back to his sponsor, and his sponsor goes, hey, here's what you do. Every time you turn in an expense report, tear up a receipt for something you paid cash for and throw it in the trash, shortchange yourself, anonymously pay the company back. He did that till the day he retired. He got to make amends. He kept his reputation, his job. That's why competent sponsorship is so important. You know, I'll give you an example. This guy was, we were going over his amends, and he allows me to tell this story. He wanted to roll down to Macon and make amends to an ex-girlfriend because they just had sex for a year and a half. He didn't have any feelings for her. I went, well, let's see what this amends is going to look like. Sorry I spent all this time doing this and didn't care about you. I went, dude, you're going to have to pray about that one and live with it. You know, I think he was hoping to rekindle personally, but, you know. And then it says, we vigorously commenced this way of living, step 10, as we cleaned up the past, step 9. That tells me, once I've made a couple of amends, I move on with 10, 11, and 12. The way I take my guys through the steps is differently. My sponsor let me suffer as long as I wanted to suffer, till it came time to drink or start writing. My sobriety was a coin toss that night. I don't want my guys to go through that. The first 100, none of them took over 40 days to work the steps. The big book uses words like quickly, suddenly, next, now, which means right now, not next week, next month, next year. It has all kind of words like that. So the book is full of time frames. Don't let anybody tell you that take your time. You've got the rest of your life to work the steps. And I'd say, hey, the rest of your life might not be very long if you mess around with this thing. We have no effective mental defense against the first drink. That defense must come from a higher power. My job to get them to that power. How am I going to get them to the power without the step process? Who knows? And how about a front row seat for 3 or 4 white light experiences? And none of them were going through the steps slowly. We had a guy, he was shaking. But his mind was there. He wasn't jittery or befogged. You know, Dr. Silkworth said, Sometimes your brain needs to clear up, jittery, or be fogged. Rarely have I ever felt like I'm taking somebody through the steps too quickly, but there's been a couple of times when I'm just going on, and this guy's getting nothing, and I start to get aggravated, and I stop, and I say, don't be an ass and run this guy off. You know, and I say, hey, let's come back a week or two from now and continue this. You know. We got this guy at our place. I'm all over the place. You'll have to excuse me. That's just the way I am. He was shaking pretty bad, and we took him in the back room, went through the first three steps in like 20 minutes. He had no God objection. He had no doubts about his alcoholism. We answered the two questions, not 71 like another fellowship. Two questions on the first step. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. So I said, hey, can you quit entirely on your own without any help? Obviously not. You're here. And the second one, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take. I just asked him, you ever overshot the mark? You know, when I take the first one, I can't guarantee my behavior. So, that's the first step. It's pretty simple. So we worked through the first three steps, got down on our knees, did the third step prayer. This guy lit up like a Christmas tree. The whole room lit up. We all experienced it. Got up off our knees. I started explaining the four step to him, handed him the worksheet, and he looked at me and he goes, I've got one question for you. I said, what? He goes, I've been in and out of AA 10 and a half years. How come I've never heard this? That blew my mind. What are we telling people in here? You know, it's pretty simple. I mean, my sponsor, that he used to sit over here when it was the smoking area, and I said, when I had about 6 months, I said, I like doing meetings. I get to talk as much as I want. He goes, shut up and point your finger. Bring a topic and try to keep the meeting in the direction of the topic. You know, because here's how it goes sometimes. This kills me. Does anybody have something they want to talk about affecting their sobriety that they might take a drink if they don't get to share? Here's what happens. First person goes, I feel like crap. Second person goes, I can relate. So do I. And then you end up with an open depression meeting. That's not good for anybody. If you go, hey, here's what I'd like to talk about. Bring up a topic. First person goes, I feel like crap. You go, this is how it relates to the topic. And the second person talks about the solution, and it's a solution-based meeting. Because, I mean, we need solution. People are dying for the truth. You know, and that's what I appreciate about this place. They didn't really care about my feelings. They said, I'd rather step on your toes and walk on your grave. You know, and I was in this room. The curtains were open at 5:45. It was packed. I had 6 months, know-it-all. I've read the book twice. I'm a know-it-all. I'm on step three. And I said, I want to talk about humility. And somebody starts screaming in the back of the room, you don't know a GD thing about humility. And I look up, my sponsor's walking out of the room, giving me that look. I'm like, wow, you know. So they weren't afraid to tell you, you know. And they cross-talked, and it was different. Anyway, you know, this is just for me. You'll have to find your own sponsorship style, what's most effective for you and your sponsees. I take people through as quickly as possible. I hit the high spots in the book, what I just told you about step one, a question about step two, a little bit about step three, and it's a little different for everybody. And then when we're done going through the steps and 2 weeks to a month, depending on our schedule, we go back through the book thoroughly, line by line, sentence by sentence. And I never did that till I had about 20 years of sobriety. And I used to open up the big book, the 12 and 12, and a book called the Annotated AA Handbook with notes from old timers. I'd lay all that crap out like a college course. I'd cram them full of information, and they'd gloss over. Their eyes would glass over. And before we were done with the first step, they were gone. You know, and then I started taking people through the... I have no problem with those other books, but the first time I take people through the book, I take them through the big book only. And when we go back through, I'll go through any book you want to go through. Because 6 and 7 is more thorough than the 12 and 12. 10th step's packed full of killer stuff in the 12 and 12. You get guys sometimes that just kind of okey-doke their way through and nod their heads, and you're like, you know they're just saying what they want you to hear. But then you get somebody and you see the light come on, and you see them catch fire and start helping others, and that just lights me up. You know, there's nothing like that. In the book it says, why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered and been given the power to help others. And that's pretty controversial, recovered. Here's my deal. I say I'm a recovered alcoholic because newcomers need to know that we do recover. It's no longer a daily battle, a struggle. I've experienced the 10th step promises, which means I'm a free man. I'm placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. That means if I walk in a bar with my friends to watch a game and eat, and somebody's getting trashed, or even worse, if they're having a good time drinking, I'm unaffected. I'm in a position of neutrality. They might as well be drinking tea. That's how much it affects me. It goes in one ear and out the other. Where did that come from? That's a God thing. You know? So I moved from here in 2003, moved up to Acworth, got a killer deal on a house, drove a car carrier for like 20 years, piled up some money, and I was at this job. I blew a bicep tendon, and they said, we're not going to pay you. Oh, that's a challenge. I went, I think you will. So I got a lawyer, made him pay me for 7 years, $425 a week cash. I traveled, went on cruises, acted like I was retired for 7 years. Now I'm probably going to have to work till I die to make up for it, but it was a good run. So 3 years ago, I lost everything I owned. Had a lot of attachment to all that stuff, the house, a couple of toys, all that garbage. My priorities were in the wrong spot, you know, and I got in this funk. I wouldn't leave my house or my room. People bring me food. People from all over the country were calling, what is wrong with you? Get up, take a shower, get your ass to a meeting. They'd come by from Howe Place and go, we're going to go to a meeting. I went, I'm not going over there, those guys. I said, why not? I said, because 33 years I ain't supposed to look like this, you know. So fast forward a while, here's what I learned from that. It says in the book, looking back, we realize when we placed ourselves in God's hands, the outcome was better than anything we could have planned. So here's what happened. I realized that things are replaceable. I wasn't a good steward of those things. Things are replaceable. Relationships are priceless. You know, and I lost my mind. There were people calling from here going, hey, were you able to put the plug in the jug? I'm like, I didn't lose my sobriety. I lost my mind. Went to the funny farm. Got out. Went back the same day. And the girl that picked me up and took me from one mental institution to another goes, my God, all this in one day? I thought it was like a month. I was that out of it. And had to take a concoction for a couple of years, and And it worked. It was the right concoction. It's different for everybody. had to find the right one, though, because I'm like, told them, I'm not going to be a zombie for anybody. So, the lie we tell ourselves is, I don't need this crap. I feel good. Guess what felt good? Because it was working. You know, and had an experience in March that just changed my whole attitude and outlook on everything. I haven't had to take any of that since then, and I'm hesitant to say that because I've seen people throw their stuff in the garbage, which I didn't do. I did it with the direction of a doctor, and my life has never been better, you know, and it's so simple today. I've had 3 incidents happen in 9 months that would have sent me off the deep end 3 years ago. And all of them, I don't stress. I'm right with God. He's right with me, apparently. Moved to Canton, rented a room. Guy comes to me after a year and goes, going to have to move. We're month to month. Lease is up. I'm renting from him. So I don't have a leg to stand on. He says, when do we need to move? He goes, 2 weeks. I'm like, oh, great. You know, so found a place to stay, did the footwork, and it came to the day I had to leave. And I'm like, I got up about 10. I slept in for hours. I could hear everybody moving. It's just me in the house. I'm like, I guess I ought to start packing. Not that I'm a procrastinator, you know. It was nice to lose everything when I could put all my crap in 2 little pickup trucks. So I called a girl, lived 50 miles away. I said, hey, can you help me move? She goes, when? I went, how about right now? She came up, Sponsee came up, tossed the stuff on the truck, moved to Kennesaw where I live now. Here's the deal. You know how long I spent worrying about all that crap? About 20 minutes on the day of the move while I was arranging people to help me and packing. Worry's a waste of time. God's got me. You know. And I'll give one more example. This girlfriend of mine been in and out of the program 30 years. She just has an issue that I'm not going to get into that is bigger than her relationship with God. And she lets it be that. So I said, hey, go talk to that big book thumper over there. Let him take you through the book. Because I call this guy. My new sponsor's been sober 46 years. Air Force retiree. 80 years old. He's in church every time the doors open. 6 days a week. Sings in the choir. I call him disturbed. And he is unaffected. And truthfully, he defends me too much. I don't need to be defended. So I call this other guy with 16 years. He listens for a minute, and he goes, you want to know what the nature of your wrongs is? I'm like, that's why I called. And he tells me the truth. So I told this girl, I said, go talk to that guy. She starts telling him her problems, and he's throwing solutions. And she's got a problem for every solution he's got. And you can see her hugging onto her problem, not wanting to let go of him. He told her, I don't know if she heard it, but I put this straight in my toolbox. He goes, we're not going to listen to those voices anymore. And so I went to St. Simon's to put a ceramic coating on a plane. This guy claims he gets 20% better fuel mileage for 3 solid years. So it paid really well. Only thing is, I know about cars. I don't know a damn thing about airplanes. So I get down there, set everything up. Look at this twin prop 6-seat huge airplane and go, I can't do this shit. Can't do it. Looked at my vehicle, got ready to throw my stuff in there, tuck my tail between my legs and come back to Atlanta. Full of shame. And I went, we don't listen to those voices anymore. You know, and I got started, knocked out the tail, the high section. The only part that needed scaffolding, got done twice what I thought I could do in a day, and the rest was a breeze. You know, it's tools like that. I'm never too far in this program to pick up a new tool, you know. I'll give you one. I was taking this guy. He's been in that AA 20-something years. I'm taking him through the book because my sponsor had me do this exercise. It helps you relate to Bill Wilson. And I sponsor a couple of women. How are they going to relate to a 39-year-old stock speculator from New York City in the 30s? This is how. For the first 8 pages, which was his drinking, because he got sober after that, write a letter next to the sentence that applies to you. A T where you thought like Bill, an F where you felt like Bill, a D where you drank like Bill. On the one page where it says, I had arrived, that I've got underlined, I put a T. I thought like that. On another page where it says, and I'll wrap this up, my sponsor told me, first time I spoke, they'd like your story a hell of a lot better if you finished 5 minutes early than 5 minutes late. On page 3, it says, the remonstrances of my friend has terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. Not road, row. I think Bill picked that up when he was in England. Row is short for rowdy. Now, if you put the definitions of the words in there, it would say, the protests of my friends terminated in a fight, and I became a lone wolf. Does that sound familiar? I put D. I drank like that. I surrounded myself with people that drank and did things the same way I did, so I didn't have to hear that. But at the end, my dealer and everybody's telling me, dude, you're nuts. I'm like, I know. So, I just like to tell you what they told me. You don't ever have to be alone again. You know, and I've gone through some things alone in Alcoholics Anonymous. Only when I chose to. Every time I put my hand out, the hand of AA was there. And it wasn't always the first hand. And sometimes it wasn't the hand that I wanted to respond. But I got the response. God has a better plan for my life than I do. And I'll give you one more example of how he works in my life. My pastor called me. He goes, got a card for you to detail. Hey, great. One of our parishioners had a miscarriage on the way to the hospital. And I'm like, I've seen too many horror movies. I was thinking this is going to be ghastly. And it wasn't bad at all. It took me about an hour to clean it up. And I said, look, I'm not going to charge you. Some things are more important than money. So the next day I went to pick up some center caps for some wheels that I sprayed the wrong chemical on and the paint came off. And $200 worth of center caps. And I jacked them up. I fixed them. That's integrity. Doing what you say you're going to do. I got to pick them up. I'm like, how come it took 6 weeks to get these things? He goes, I don't know. Let me call the salesman. Salesman goes, oh, my God, I forgot to push send. I'm sitting there holding them in my hand. I forgot to push send. Just keep them. $200. That was more than I'd have got paid for the. God works that way. You know. I'll say this and be done. One of my favorite guys, Emmett Fox, greatly influenced the writers of the literature, early AA. And he talks about a mistake we make is we pray for God. We pray for something from God. We outline what the answer ought to look like. You know, and God's given me a better, something better than I even prayed for. But I'm looking for this blue shirt, and I miss, you know, the suit. So, you know, I just try to stay open-minded and let it flow. Thanks for letting me ramble.
Thank you, Tom. It's always a pleasure.
Was the last thing I wanted to do. There ain't no denying the pain you put me through. I thought I knew you so well. Guess I have to blame myself for letting you burn. till I was head down, hellbound, digging a hole in my soul, got tired, wound up, burned out, devil turned a good girl into a liar. I didn't come here looking for the light, no, no, I came in here running from the fire. Sweet talking, heartbreaker, you had me believe that you love me, but you gave me one match and gasoline. It all happened so fast, nothing was left but ashes. I should have seen it coming, but I was head down, hellbound, digging that hole and my soul got tired, wound up. Devil turned a good girl into a liar. I didn't come here looking for the light. No, no, I came in here running from the fire. There are lessons I'm still learning, hearts I've broken, are still hurting. It's all because of you and the things you made me do. I was head down, hellbound, digging a hole in my soul, got tired, wound up, burned out. Devil turned a good girl into a liar. I didn't come here looking for the light. No, no, I came in here running from the fire. Oh, I didn't come here looking for the light. No, I came in here running from the fire. That's right. Head down.